everybody, and welcome to the latest Dad's Army podcast. This is a slightly different episode from normal. It's a commentary episode, and I'm going to be talking about Number Engaged. That's a series 9 episode, and really quite late in the Dad's Army run. Now, I haven't done a commentary episode for a long time now, so it's going to be slightly different in format this time, in as much as, one, I'm recording this intro, which I didn't do before, and two, in a moment, you'll hear some music. Now, after that music has finished, you'll hear a countdown. And just after one, if you press play on your DVD player or your computer, however it is that you're watching the episode, then you'll be watching Number Engaged more or less in sync with me as I was recording this particular commentary. So I hope that's all nice and clear, and feel free to let us know what you think of the format of this episode. James@dadsarmypodcast.com, and I look forward to speaking to you soon in a few minutes. Three, two, one, play. Hello and welcome to podcast number 39. This time round, it's a commentary episode. This is going to be on the series 9 episode Number Engaged. I'm really pleased to say that I'm joined once again by Oliver Crocker.
Hello there.
Hi, and we are obviously recording this as a live commentary. Now, this might not necessarily be as slick and smooth and as professional as you're used to with a podcast, and that's because I get to edit it and delete all my fluffs. This time, however, and I haven't done a commentary for a very long time, I don't get to correct anything I say.
But I'm sure that won't be necessary, James.
Yes, well, and I can't edit out unwarranted flattery either. There you go. So anyway, Number Engaged then, it was originally broadcast, according to my Wikipedia notes, on the 6th of November 1977.
Right.
So I was 4 years old. How old were you, whatever?
I was minus 9.
You just really achieved making me feel so flippin' old in some way. Anyway, this opening scene here is, I believe, one of the very, very few studio scenes.
Yes.
In this episode.
Yeah, that's right. It's very heavily location, and presumably they never went... Well, you know, they never set up a church hall in this one, did they? Am I about to be proved wrong?
No, I think you're about to be proved right. You can see through the door there.
Oh, it's just like a little like a little flat.
Yes, it might be. I'm not quite sure whether they had the hall set up for a different episode, perhaps, because this is a very, very small scene here.
Yes.
So you'd have thought they would have recorded it along with some other studio scenes for different episodes.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, one thing I always look at when I'm watching the later Dad's Armies is the sort of tint of orange of Arthur Lowe's moustache, because I've seen from photos, particularly all the ones when he's with Philip Maddock, that he's actually white. So I gather that they actually used to colour his hair prior to recording, because in the photographs of a lot of them, it's white. And certainly in what's that episode called with Philip Maddock?
Oh, The Deadly Attachment. The Deadly Attachment. It's not a very famous one.
No. Arthur's, like, moustache and hair is really red, whereas here it's quite faint. But
do you know, it's really interesting, because I've never paid much attention to his hair or the way he looks or the colour. But it's partially because I'm colourblind and probably a little bit unobservant as well. But I will notice that in future. I will check.
This reminds me of the scene when they in the episode The Pier it reminds there's Frank.
Yeah, indeed. Menace of the Deep,
Yeah. And it's presumably why Frank and Bill and Teddy have come into the scene, because in that scene in Menace from the Deep, it was a great scene for Jimmy Beck to shine with all the sort of the in-jokes. And it really shows, particularly in this episode for me, because it's more about the visual gags when we're on location. How much Jimmy Beck was missed from this, because he got to do so much of the physical stuff, but also the cheeky Cockney stuff. I really think you notice it, particularly in the very last series, because everyone, I mean, Dear John is not looking very well in the last series either. I think you can tell it's sadly coming to an end.
This, yeah, I think you're right. It you can definitely tell that the actors don't look as well as they used to. And yeah. I think John Lemessurier is the prime case in point, really. I mean, I think this was this the penultimate episode?
It was.
I think it was, wasn't it? Yeah. So this is only one more episode to record after this.
Yeah.
And they knew. I've just been reading Arnold Ridley's son's new book.
Yeah.
And he has a very brief paragraph about the final episode, because Arnold Ridley's wife appears in Never Too Old.
Oh, really?
Yeah, right at the end. And lots of other family members and friends.
Oh, as part of the big wedding.
The wedding entourage.
Oh,
yeah.
Wonderful.
Which is really, really interesting. But the production crew and probably the people in charge at the BBC knew this was coming to an end. They knew it couldn't carry on.
Yeah.
And, I mean, Arnold Ridley was, 87 or 88, I think. He was into his late 80s. I think. I probably got that wrong.
Well,
I think
he was 81, because they celebrated his 80th birthday on stage on the tour. But he was 88 when he died, which was in 84.
Yeah,
so he had a very good innings, Arnold Ridley.
I'm glad you're here to correct me. Otherwise, someone would have to email me in and tell me I'm wrong. But even so, they were planning. They were continually concerned about the health of the lead actors how they were going to get them up to Thetford, how much location shooting they could actually do, what would happen if one of them felt ill, during location. And it must have been a concern, I think. But with John Lemessurier, and again, I've heard this said, that although he does look quite gaunt in this last series, he looks quite drawn. His speech sometimes is more slurred than it normally was. People say that he actually started getting better after Dad's Army had finished, and he started looking a bit more like his old self.
That's absolutely right. I've read John's autobiography, and there's a TV film he did with Anthony Hopkins shortly before his death, and he looks actually very healthy. In fact, I think he put on weight, shortly before his death. So it's good to know that he didn't, because he died in 83. So it was still six more years of John Lemessurier to enjoy. And I'm pleased that he didn't stay as ill as he sadly looks here.
No, absolutely.
Something I spotted in this scene, he's probably not going to appear again on screen, but playing the sergeant in that scene was Kenneth MacDonald, who played Mike, the barman, in Only Fools and Horses.
Really?
Yeah, a very, very early appearance.
Didn't know that. Now, have we missed that point already, or is he coming up?
I think he's just got onto the van. Mannering and everyone have relieved him.
Okay.
But that's a young Kenneth MacDonald who sadly died quite young in 1999. So it's a shame we didn't get to hear what it was like.
No, absolutely. It would have been a good source of information. Now, this particular scene is clearly studio again.
Yes.
And I mean, it's one of the things that always jar, I think, is when they switch from videotape to film.
Absolutely.
I mean, it's impossible, I think, to make that look a smooth transition. However, I think people expected it. They probably didn't notice it, and we notice it far more in hindsight. But is this, I wonder, the same studio or the same set moved around a little bit from as the church hall?
I would have thought so. I imagine you're absolutely right. And from when watching this scene before, I think he gets quite an abrupt edit somewhere here on John Laurie's speech. It just doesn't. Oh, because I've read the full scripts of Dad's Army, so you can actually read where the cuts happened.
Well, it's funny you see, because I think you've mentioned that before when I've spoken to you, and I have got a script book now, and I've tried to follow a script whilst watching it, and it's impossible.
Yeah,
because none of them stick to the script.
No,
I can't tell the difference between a fluff, an ad lib, or a cut.
Yeah,
now, I'd love to know, same as everybody else would, what was cut on the day, who actually made that decision. Were some of the actors a bit bolshy and said, I'm not saying that, that's out of character, or I don't want to say that?
Yeah.
Was it Croft? Was it Perry?
Do you know why the last series was directed by Bob Spears?
I don't. I think you can tell that the direction is slightly different.
Absolutely right.
And I think also, I have a feeling that he directed a few episodes from Series 8 as well.
Right.
I think he directed Ring Them Bells, but I could be slightly wrong there. Again, I'm sure someone will correct me. But I think, if you have a look at... no, I've got that wrong, sorry. It's Don't Forget the Diver.
All right, okay.
Yeah, I always get those two mixed up. but if you have a look, you see the same kind of shots in the church hall,
yeah,
but at a slightly different angle.
Yeah.
And that's the mark, in my view, of a young director trying to make a name for himself.
Yes.
You know? And
yes.
Bob Spears, as I said, only got a few, I think. I can't remember how many he did direct, but he certainly went and directed Fawlty Towers.
Yes, he did. It's a very prolific... this is an interesting little scene, isn't it? It's very theatrical. And again, I think I'm right in this. After Jimmy Beck died, there are a lot more scenes between Pikey and Jones, because before, Jimmy Beck had a lot of interaction between Jones's character, whereas Ian's character really focused with the bank. So this was a nice little partnership, I think, that developed in the later episodes.
I couldn't agree more. And people are... I mean, I've always been quite critical of Jones's character in the past, because I find him, you know, his antics slow down the story sometimes. It's,
yes.
You know, we have to go into a massive Jones soliloquy.
Yeah.
Sometimes it's funny, sometimes it's not. I always get told off for having a go at Jones. However, when I said that last time, I've got a whole barrage of support, which I'm going to go reading. I'm going to read to the audience soon.
Yeah.
Once I get around to recording the next podcast. But anyway, I'm digressing. But these scenes between Pike and Jones are great. And
yeah.
There's actually quite a lot littered through the whole run of Dad's Army. And there's this scene. There's the scene in When You've Got to Go, when Pike knows he's going to be called up.
Oh, yes. They're in the bunker, is that right?
That's right.
Yep.
When Pike gets his head stuck through the park gate.
Yes.
What's that, Man of Action, I think?
Yes.
This is all live. We can't go and look this up, unfortunately.
That's right.
That's
a fantastic episode, Man of Action. That's a great episode.
It completely descends into sheer lunacy.
Yeah.
And also there's the face on the poster where they're discussing eggs and so on.
Yes.
And I love those little scenes because Clive Dunn isn't being... idiotic, mm-hmm. and he isn't here. He's actually telling another one of his old stories.
Yeah,
in a different way to usual.
Absolutely, there's a slight in a way, as you mentioned, that you think some of the production crew knew it was coming to an end, and you have that little in joke where Pikey asks, you know, why do you always do that on your hip in that scene, and it's almost like bringing that little joke to a close in a way. And it's quite weird. When I first saw this episode, which I would have seen on telly rather than a DVD, I didn't know it was a penultimate one.
Mm.
Now knowing that, it does make a lot of sense in a way.
It adds a little bit of context
to
the portrayal sometimes. And I think this one, it's noticeable in this one. People always say it about Never Too Old.
Yes.
You know, they always say there's like... well, it's a kind of sword of Damocles, really. They knew it was coming to an end, so they gave it absolutely everything.
Yes.
Whereas this one, it's subtle. It's a little bit more subtle. And I wonder whether or not the direction, again, you know, someone said, well, let's have the picture in picture, like we're seeing at the moment.
Yes.
If
Frank was here, he would tell me about a David Niven movie, which reminded him when we watched this on television together not long ago, Frank and I, and he was saying how it's quite a famous war movie, which I'm afraid I don't know the title of because I'm ignorant, where David Niven is about to crash his plane, and a lady, like in that scene, is on the radio sort of guiding him down, and they said, well, wouldn't it be great to meet up? It's quite a famous film, and that reminded Frank in that little moment there.
Well, I wonder how many influences Dad's Army actually had that we'll never actually know.
Yeah,
because
absolutely.
Obviously there's the more time that goes on, the less connection there is with the actual period when these scripts were written.
Yeah.
And you know, there's a chap who's emailed me recently, a chap called James White Aldworth. Hello, James, if you're listening. I got your email this morning, incidentally. And he's written me a huge email. It goes on for pages. And what he's done is listed every single film reference ever mentioned in Dad's Army.
Well,
list it. He's put it in a spreadsheet.
That's very impressive.
Yeah, well, I'm going to put it on the blog, James. So it's because I think people will find it interesting. Every time every character mentions it, he said where it comes from. He's done research and actually watched a couple of the films, so fantastic. He would probably know which film, you know, if that was actually drawn from, perhaps, because it's similar. I've just been waffling, but I love that little scene we've just missed.
It is a very nice little scene. I mean, Arthur Lowe was an absolute genius with physical comedy, and considering he was a man in his older years, I think he does that. He's very agile, you know, amazing. One of the very, very best.
And have you noticed towards the ends of the run again, every time there's a visual gag, Pike is in it with Manorin.
Yes, absolutely.
You know, they clearly thought, it's got to be Pike and Manorin, you know.
Yeah.
And they do work very well, but it's very funny.
Yeah, absolutely. Funny. Now, something we... you and I discussed before doing this was an absence of Arnold Ridley in the location scenes, and watching those previous studio scenes as well, he doesn't appear to be there, which makes me wonder, in fact, whether it was shot at the same, because he was in the very opening scene. So I think you're probably absolutely right in that they filmed that opening scene with the blackboard and the chalk along with another episode, presumably.
You could well be right. Now, I always understood Arnold Ridley not to be present on location, but I've just seen in the background the back of someone who's got white hair. Now, I wonder whether or not that was deliberate.
Always to make you look thinking.
Yeah, because I know Ridley wasn't here. I know he wasn't. It's an acknowledged fact. But now we'll have to wait and see if we get a background shot again, because Godfrey is referred to in this exchange.
And I believe there's a CSO shot coming up where Arnold is inserted in. And it's quite amazing. They insert him in from presumably inside, suggesting that he brings his medical bag.
There you are, on the right. Now, that is not Arnold Ridley.
No.
It is not Arnold Ridley.
No, that's what he's looking at. Now, I'm
wondering which one on the back row. Again, see, not in shot there.
Yeah.
That's a little bit closer.
Yeah.
So,
here we go. Plot point.
Yeah, absolutely. Large bomb.
There's some great facial acting about. It's brilliant.
There is, and they use that trick with a camera twice to zoom in on the bomb.
Yes.
So, but it is interesting. There we are again. You see.
Oh look, that's not. Yeah, you're absolutely right. Running back inside,
you could see that wasn't him.
Yeah,
I think so. Do you know, someone's going to correct me now?
No, I think you're absolutely right, because if it was him, you would have seen him in close up.
I'm pretty certain. I'm pretty certain it wasn't.
And now I think the CSO clip comes up.
I think you're quite right. He's going to. Manorin mentions something about Godfrey in a minute.
Yeah, but, he sort of replies to Godfrey. So I wonder whether Arnold was ill or whether he was unable. Just, you know.
I'm sure we'll be able to find out, and I'll tell you who will know. Hello, Mr. Carpenter, look, if you're listening. There. Yeah, there you go. There he is.
Because he's a. Look,
and look at his hair, it's shorter.
Yeah.
So absolutely. He definitely wasn't the guy who we thought it might be.
That's right.
Or who thought he looked like it, yeah.
Yeah.
And you could tell it jars, as I said, between the videotape and the film.
That's absolutely right, yeah. And that very slight. I mean, I'm trying to think now what colour CSO they'd have used at this time. Probably blue, I think. Just from thinking of Doctor Who, it was also using it quite large.
CSO, which is colour separation overlay, it was seen at the time as a massive development in, you know, and not only that, probably one that actually saved them quite a bit of dosh.
Yeah.
Because why actually bother going somewhere if you could just put a big picture in the background? And Doctor Who took this to the nth degree, and they're thinking, well, let's just CO in a field.
Yeah, yeah.
Because we don't have to go to a field.
A story called Underworld springs to mind, set entirely in caves, and they're all CSO. And it's now it's quite a historic piece of television, but sadly looks rather embarrassing.
Well, I think the reason we've got such good special effects today is because people like Baronets in particular were keen to experiment, probably too much, let's say, with a new piece of technology.
Absolutely.
But that's the reason why, I mean, people did use it. It's how technology gets better, I suppose. Is that people use it, it gets a little bit more developed. However, there's only two occasions that I can think of that it's used in Dad's Army.
Okay.
There's this one, and there's one other episode. Which is probably a more obvious one. You kick yourself.
Battle of the Giants.
Oh, do you know what? I hadn't thought of that. Which part are you thinking?
With Jonesy hanging on the flagpole.
Of course. Yeah. Oh, you're absolutely right.
We've got three. You're going to tell me.
There's another one. There's another one.
Arfalo doubling himself.
Absolutely. Yeah. My brother and I.
Yes, yes.
And that, I remember when I first saw that, and that would have had to have been probably mid, possibly late 80s. I was really impressed with the way
that holds up.
I still think it's good. The reason why they don't look as special these days when you watch them on DVD is because they've done such a fantastic job at restoring them, and the picture is great now.
So. Yes, absolutely. This actor on the left appeared in Dad's Army on a couple other occasions, I believe.
You're absolutely right. Now, let me think. It's not Eric Chitty. Is he the chap who's in Something Nasty in the Vaults, who comes to defuse the bomb? Or have I got that?
No, this chap comes and asks Arthur for money on a couple...
Swan. When did you last see... No. High Finance.
Yes, absolutely.
This is completely unedited. Yeah. You're actually hearing us think.
Yeah.
So we get there in the end.
And this is like more or less exactly the same character, really, isn't it? It's a lovely performance, but it's sort of before, who can we get in to do this little bit?
Do you know, it's funny you mentioned that, the same actor playing two different parts identically, because I read something again fairly recently about what John LeMessurier has said, and his advice to young actors was, I think it was the advice to James Beck actually, is don't ever play anything other than one character, and if possible try to wear the same suit.
and if you think
about it, John LeMessurier played the same
character.
I mean, I think it's actually very harsh because he does vary his performance depending on what you're watching.
Yes, yes.
But he was well known, and I think probably won the part in Dad's Army because of the way he plays, his roles in general.
He was a wonderful actor that had that natural charm and charisma that obviously was part of himself. I've never heard a bad word said about John LeMessurier, from Frank or from Ronnie Grange, who worked with them all for a number of years. And in fairness, I haven't heard a bad story about any of them. I mean, it does sound like they're a very happy cast.
I think so. And I think people will probably by now have let any really bad stories come out. There's always this animosity. Well, I say animosity, that's the wrong word, but there's the conflict perhaps between Arnold Ridley and John Lorre.
Yes.
Because they could never remember, they never really know who was the oldest. Now, I know it's a fact, but Arnold Ridley always used to add 1 year to his life, and eventually he got so confused he didn't know how old he was.
Right.
So much so that there's actually a correction on his gravestone.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Wow.
So it's not really surprising that people got confused. So and John Lorre was attacked being elderly in a completely different way.
Absolutely.
And he was always saying, well, why does he get a chair? I don't get a chair. And all of this kind of thing. And people talk about that as saying it was just gentle ribbing. But I wonder. You never know, do you?
These
stories do get massively distorted over time, I'm sure.
That's Felix Bonus, who sadly passed away rather recently.
Yes.
But Felix did a lot of warm-up acts before the studio performances, and he appears in a number of episodes, I believe. Yeah. But this is a lovely the word blastage just getting repeated over and over again.
Wait, who do you think was that Jimmy Perry?
Absolutely. It's one of those. Sorry, Arnold Ridley double again in the background, leaning over, sort of always looking to the ground.
I shall check.
I've never noticed that before until you said it, and now you're absolutely right, and it seems a very strange thing to have done.
Now, is he there? Is he in that shot there? And I'll tell you something about that van in a minute, but no, can't see him. Yeah, scan in the background. That van is Hodge's van, with a back taken off and the plates changed. Oh dear.
Well,
it must have been a different day.
Well, absolutely, because that's. Where is he in the wide?
Hang on. Where is he there?
And that's his double behind Teddy Sinclair. He's been inserted in. He'd be up that pole in Grease Lightning.
I know he wasn't there at least one day. Maybe there were 2 days. I mean, as I said, I have a feeling that we'll be told reasonably soon.
Yeah, well, that's clearly an insert, and so maybe Arnold just wasn't very well on this day.
But anyway, yeah, going back to the van, that van is Hodges' van with the back taken off and the plates changed.
The ring Frank is wearing, Metzstein, he still owns. It's a little black ring on his little finger, and he may well still wear it. I've certainly seen him wear it when we did Tanner together. He said, I wore this in Dad's Army.
It's funny how you see these personal things that just, you know, span the decades.
Yeah.
Now, that, to me, looks like Ian Lavender.
Yes.
Now, the thing is, in the script books, it tells you that there is another stuntman. And
presumably to do with...
I think it's the fall.
Yeah.
I think it's the fall.
Well, fair play to Ian. I mean, I wouldn't have gone up there.
No, not at all. But when the stuntman fell, because he did actually fall, he was quite a young stuntman.
Right.
You know, he landed okay, but there was a chest of drawers landed on his head, knocked him out. It actually knocked him out. He was unconscious for a few minutes. I've forgotten his name now. So I wonder if this is it, when you got the wide shot there again. It's all very interesting. And apparently the porridge that they made, because they weren't too certain how much porridge they needed, they did end up with an awful lot extra.
Yeah.
And it really was porridge.
Oh, wow.
I wonder how many times they ended up having to do that.
Oh, dear.
Stuck in manure. I think this one as well, Mannering gives Pike a particularly hard time.
He does.
Well, yeah, I mean, I'm sure it's all for comic effect, obviously, but at the same time, Mannering doesn't do anything sensible in this episode.
No, he doesn't come up with the answer.
No, not at all. It's a shame, really, because it's so close to the end of the series. They play on his buffoonery a bit, which I think works well as a contributory part
to
Menowin's character,
but
not when it's the main four. You know, he spends all that time trying to get up the pole in the, the spiky star, boots or whatever, and it's never going to work.
No.
It's really laboured.
Yeah, it was in that... The episode where he very heroically climbs onto the back of a van, some sort of explosive is involved, and they play that very famous music.
Fallen Idol, yes. You're talking about.
Oh, that's right, because that's the episode where he's drunk and he needs to regain his dignity with the troops.
So he's got some motivation. Though.
Yeah, and he's the action hero. They are quite sort of funny in a way, Dad's Army episodes, because... You can have someone like Jones being an absolute wally on some occasions, yet be a hero in others, you know. And I think you've got to take it with a pinch of salt, the continuity of the way they act.
You're right, you are right. And I think the way that we analyse it at times, and others on the podcast as well, obviously the show was never actually designed to be analysed in as much detail. And considering how much things we get wrong as well, then, you know, it's probably a little bit unfair to analyse it. But if you look for, I mean, today, if this was made today, or a similar kind of... comedy was made today, each of the characters would have stories, they'd have arcs, they'd you know, they'd have a journey to go on, and there'd be some deliberate character development. Now I think that they pepper character development throughout the series. Occasionally you get to see into the personal life of a character here and there, as opposed to it being a deliberate thing. And I like those episodes where you do get to find out a little bit more. But this, I don't think you find out anything about anybody here, do you?
No,
I mean, that's
all Clive, by the looks of it. It's amazing.
I think there was a stuntman again, because there's a story in the book from someone who was actually in the cherry picker where Clive Dunn was,
I don't know,
at the time. Again, a lot of his stuff is in close-up, so he might not be that far from the ground, who knows.
It looked quite heavy, that. I wonder whether it was an actual replica, either that or Clive was doing some very good lifting acting.
Maybe. And, of course, we're coming to the end of this this episode now, I think.
Rather fast.
Well, this is the thing, you see. You start talking about Dad's Army and there is so much to go on about. This ending... Some episode endings I really enjoy. Others, I think... And I don't know, Jones sitting on telephone lines to get in a shock up his bum. I don't know.
Yeah, it's not. I mean, you know, I don't think it's the greatest Dad's Army. I think it's, well, obviously it was full of probably you haven't got Arnold Ridley there, which presumably wasn't planned. And I don't know, Bob Spears' direction differs from David Croft, in my opinion, through pace. I think Croft's direction had a lot more pace than Bob Spear. Ronnie Brody, that's the chap who was doing that.
And Kenneth McDonald, you're absolutely spot on, Felix Bonus. You know much more than I do off the top of your head. So.
Well, his face never really changed, Kenneth McDonald. Yeah. I thought, well, you look at that. And I like the fact that they kept these totals the same. I was a big fan of Jimmy Beck. I was a big fan of it as an actor and a character, and I think it's very touching they kept that there.
I'm glad they did. There we are, studio director.
Oh, so he didn't direct the location? Look at that for a last minute.
Okay, well, I think we probably better make a move before we completely get everything else wrong. Bob Spears directed the studio element to Number Engaged.
So he had a short day.
Anyway, Oliver, thank you once again for joining me on the podcast.
It's been an absolute pleasure.
Well, I'm looking very much looking forward to the next time we have you on as
Absolutely.
Well.
Absolutely, so am I.
Okay.
Brilliant, thank you.
Bye, everybody.